This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's kind of a numbers game right now, with the faces of the desperate on each and every one of those numbers. Can Europe accept 160,000 refugee migrants? That's the latest proposal from the Middle East. 160,000 out of more than 4 million.
I really hope that this time everyone will be on board. No poems, no rhetorics. Action is what is needed for the time being.
That's European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker speaking this week as Danish police closed the railway between Denmark and Germany because 300 refugees, including children, began walking the tracks. There is something petty and superficial about these quotas as Europe negotiates. What are they based on? Who can say how many people Denmark or Hungary can or should accept? It brings to mind the expression women and children first, the protocol when sailing vessels were evacuated into lifeboats. There was no quota. It was get the helpless and innocent out first, period. This impulse was behind the very humble but heroic rescue effort that brought thousands of refugee Jewish children from Nazi Germany to the UK between 1938 and 1940. It was small scale. It came despite the reluctance of nations to accept displaced people, and it was called kinder transport. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks served as chief rabbi of the UK from 1991 and 2013, and he believes that a kinder transport gesture is needed today for the thousands of refugee children crowding the EU borders. Now Rabbi Sacks says it's as important for the world, including the United States, to offer hope as well as sanctuary for the thousands left behind and waiting, which he says is exactly what kinder transport managed to do back in the 1930s.
Jews had been trying to leave Germany. And in July 1938, 32 countries came together in the French spa town of Evian to discuss the crisis. And basically what happened was every nation closed its doors. And it was in the midst of this that a few heroic individuals organized this rescue by train of 10,000 Jewish children from Germany. And it became the great spot of light in the midst of one of the dark periods of human history.
The period of post-Holocaust Europe did not have the divisions between Muslim and Jew that we understand today. Is there anything about that time and that sense of or lack of xenophobia between Muslims and Jews that could help us in this time to assimilate Muslims, to welcome Muslims, to embrace the Muslims who are trapped in Syria?
Well, I certainly think, and I tried to do this for all those decades, two and a bit decades that I was chief rabbi in Britain, to say that we should be exporting a message of coexistence from Britain to the Middle East instead of importing a message of conflict from the Middle East to Britain. Because in Britain, we got on very well, the Jewish and Muslim communities. We worked at that relationship. Locally in Britain, we have managed those relationships well. But there is a huge spillover in Europe of the politics of the Middle East, because today, with all our global media, a conflict anywhere very rapidly becomes a conflict everywhere.
Why is it so hard for Israelis to imagine Nahariya or Haifa or other territories inside of Israel or even the West Bank as being a sanctuary for some of these people from Syria? It's in some cases walking distance.
Oh, I'm sure they would want to provide sanctuary, as they've done at a medical level, very much so. I mean, there are a lot of Syrians being treated in Israeli hospitals at the moment, and you've got Israeli doctors going out to where the great mass of refugees are. Because of the political sensitivities, these acts of medical aid and so on are being done well beneath the radar screen. But I know they're happening. And I know there are Syrian refugees being treated in Israeli hospitals at the moment.
I'm glad to hear that. As someone who spent plenty of time in the Middle East myself, you know, looking at the ironies of history and the tragedies of history, and there are plenty in that region, do you think the inability, for whatever reason, for the Arabs and the Israelis in Palestine and Israel to deal with the repatriation questions of refugees from 1948 and 1967 has caused an opportunity to be lost for Israel to project itself as a sanctuary, which it certainly was for Jews after World War II.
Look, I think it's continued to be a sanctuary. There's no question that Israel is one of the only two countries in the world, the United States being the other, which was built on and exists as a refuge for asylum seekers. There's no doubt that Israel has offered asylum, but at the same time, you understand that many Syrians themselves, they are worried that if they take refuge in Israel, they will never be allowed back into Syria. That's the real problem.
Would you say that what you know about, and you've talked about a lot that's under the radar, is a policy of the Netanyahu government that they welcome sanctuary in Israel?
No. I mean, this is part of the deep-rooted Israeli feeling that we're here to be a blessing. You know, we're in our synagogue this Saturday. We're all going to read those famous words of Moses at the end of his life, I set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse, choose life. I think Israel is predicated on that principle of choose life. So they've always tried to do this. And I think the international isolation of Israel has inhibited that and set up barriers where there really should not be barriers. I think it would do an enormous amount to heal some of the wounds in the Middle East.
If
Israel were actively able to be seen to be engaged in these acts of refuge and acts of aid, medical, agricultural, and economic.
Should the U.S. do more?
I have the feeling it is an enormous country that has thus far taken in relatively few refugees from the Middle East. But as a British visitor here, the last thing I would wish to do is tell America how to deal with this.
Why not?
Because I try and be polite, and Europe is finding it hard enough.
Is it impolite to suggest that America, who invaded Iraq and perhaps created the circumstances for much of this migration, should not bear a greater responsibility? Is that something that we restrain from talking about because we're polite?
Okay, I'm going to be very blunt.
Let's do that.
Let's be very blunt. I think humanitarian gestures go further to change the climate of international politics than military interventions. Military interventions leave behind a legacy of resentment. Humanitarian interventions leave behind a legacy of gratitude. So if I were talking about long-term winning the peace, I would say that being a home for refugees is probably the single most effective thing Europe and the United States can do.
So, you know, billions for weapons, but a single gesture of Kinder transport from Damascus to Washington, D.C.,
yeah,
or some courageous Israeli standing up and saying, Hassan in Raqqa, come and live with me. This changes the world, whereas more weapons.
Correct. More weapons simply reinforce all the conflicts of the past and allow us to replay and replay and replay conflicts which are never resolved.
So, Rabbi, where's the courage? It seems so simple. It's not like, not simple, like stupid simple, but it just...
I think Angela Merkel is showing that courage right now.
Really?
I think she's talking about bringing in as many as 800,000 refugees. That would be far more than all of the rest of Europe put together. This is courageous, and it is very clearly being driven by a sense of historical memory, pain, grief, guilt, an attempt to redeem the past. And I think when you do attempt to redeem the past by an act of generosity and open-heartedness and an open-door policy, then you do actually change the world. This is the history that we remember and that give us hope as human beings.
So then, and I'm no theologian, but that redemption is an option for America too.
I think so.
That
yeah.
Redemption is an option for the Gulf countries who have much to answer for.
Correct.
In all of this.
Correct.
If you were standing on deck of a ship that was loaded with children from Syria who were headed to destinations unknown
but sanctuary assured, but with a future full of question marks.
Mm.
What would you advise them? What would you tell them to reassure them based on your knowledge of history?
I think it was an American historian who calculated that there have only been 29 years of peace since human civilization began. So war is the eternal story. But I think too much hope has been sucked out of the atmosphere of the Middle East. And although it's another subject for another time, I do believe that Jews, Christians, and Muslims have to come together and say we are all members of the family of Abraham. And there is such a thing as reconciliation. Genesis is full of sibling rivalries, but it ends with reconciliation between Joseph and his brothers. And bear in mind the fact that Joseph's brothers wanted to kill him and eventually sold him as a slave. So I think that the children of Abraham have a literature of hope. And I think I would sit with those children and talk those stories through and say, that is your story and it is my story. And together, we can build a world if we're willing to make that our story today as well.
Rabbi Jonathan Sacks served as chief rabbi of the UK from 1991 to 2013. As humanitarians like Rabbi Sacks call on the world to do more, they also warn against rhetoric that suggests any of this is easy, or addressable with military means, or Donald Trump-style border walls. In fact, here's candidate Trump sounding annoyed about taking more Syrian refugees in the United States, as though they were something left behind on one of his construction sites.
I hate the concept of it, but on a humanitarian basis with what's happening, you have to. You know, this was started by President Obama when he didn't go in and do the job when he should have, when he drew the line in the sand, which turned out to be a very artificial line.
Going in to do what job? Nice sounding lines in the sand that get covered with blood in the chaos of civil war. How we got here is not going to help us get out of this. It's a lesson about clarity and being able to focus on what is important in times of crisis. And that's exactly what the Kinders Transport Program managed to do. It didn't stop World War II. It didn't topple Hitler. It did save thousands of lives. British humanitarian Sir Nicholas Winton was a man who saw the shadow descending on Europe in the 1930s and helped to set up the rescue of Jewish kids from Czechoslovakia, 669 of them. He lived until he was 106, but never spoke about what he had done until just before his death, when he told the BBC of his sadness about the world once again failing to see what he saw so long ago.
I don't think we ever learn from the mistakes of the past. I mean, we're now, the world today is in a more dangerous situation than it has ever been. And so long as you've got the weapons of mass destruction, which can finish off any conflict, nothing is safe anymore.
British humanitarian Sir Nicholas Winton.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.